This is Jeff Jackson, and you're listening to Rock is Lit.
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 You're listening to Rock is Lit with Christy Halberg. Rock on, Christy.
Is lit.
Hey, lit listeners. Thanks for tuning in to Rock is Lit, the first and still only podcast devoted to rock novels, and also the 2024 American Writing Awards Podcast of the Year in the categories of music and arts. Rock is Lit is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcast Network.
Hi, this is Jimmy Kimmel, and you're listening to Pantheon Podcast.
Rock is Lit is hosted, produced, and edited by me, Christy Alexander Halberg, author of my own rock novel, Searching for Jimmy Page. Special shout out to this semester's Rock is Lit interns, production intern Cater Jones, and social media intern Jenna Rudolph. Find out more about me and Rock is Lit on Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube at Christy Halberg. Visit my website at ChristyAlexanderHalberg.com. And for goodness sakes, subscribe, comment, leave a 5-star rating and all that good stuff on your podcast platform of choice. Wyatt, the Rock is Lit mascot, and I thank you for your support.
Ladies and gentlemen, the show starts in 3, 2, 1.
The 50th episode of Rock is Lit Celebration continues with Part 2, featuring my pal Nathan D. Duval, who also appeared on the very first episode when Jeff Jackson joined the podcast to discuss his novel Destroy All Monsters, a story about fictional mid-level bands who are attacked by their fans while they perform. Nathan and I had a blast in the final segment of that episode, relaying real-life instances when that sort of thing actually happened. Think Dimebag Daryl for starters. This time, Nathan joins me and this semester's Rock is Lit production intern Cater Jones to talk about a few musicians who, like the enigmatic underground rock star Ken Mersey in Jeff's novel Mira Corpora, featured in Part 1 of Episode 50, mysteriously vanished. Nathan D. Duval is a drummer, music producer, and music publisher who for a brief period was one of the top music supervisors working the advert campaigns for the Lord of the Rings trilogy, Harry Potter, and Kill Bill. He helped launch Halo and Call of Duty before focusing his efforts on independent music publishing. His biggest productions are Requiem for a Tower from Lord of the Rings The Two Towers and a cover of Led Zeppelin's song Kashmir with the London Studio Orchestra and Damian Marley. Nathan now produces Lucid, a music and conversation program airing Mondays 2 to 4 p.m. on 103.3 Asheville FM in Asheville, North Carolina. He also edits these episodes down to a music and conversation podcast on Spotify called Lucid Pilot. Since our forthcoming discussion is inspired by the character Ken Mersey in Mira Corpora, have a listen to author Jeff Jackson reading a short excerpt about Ken from his novel. Then, join Nathan D. Duval, Cater Jones, and me for a lively combo about actual musicians who have disappeared.
I peek my head inside. These two boys and a girl are the only customers in the dingy dining room. They seem lost in heady conversation. A cardboard stencil is propped next to the girl's teacup. It's a king's crown with a line through it. As I ease myself inside, the metal prayer bell tied to the door handle gives a harsh jingle, and the trio spins around. I stumble a few steps toward them. My mind stammers. I'm dumbstruck, or terrified, or maybe just overexcited. No emotion stands still long enough to name. I have no idea how to explain myself, so I remove the plastic tape case from my sweatshirt and hold it out, by way of introduction. The trio silently consults one another, then motions me over to their booth. None of them seems surprised by my presence. "We were wondering when we'd run into you," the girl says. Looking at them sitting here, next to a fish tank filled with stunted carp, and surrounded by strains of pinched Eastern folk music, something occurs to me. The obviousness and enormity of it buckles my knees. In a hushed and imploring voice, I ask, "Did you make the music on this tape?" It's impossible to read the contorted shapes their faces make, the cryptic crisscrosses of furrowed brows and creased lips. They look like I've just complimented their dead mother's ass. The girl finally speaks up. "That's not us," she says. "The singer on that tape is Kin Mersey." The trio introduce themselves. The girl calls herself Lena. Her hair is a tangle of red, yellow, and black ringlets, the roots of previous dye jobs aggressively on display. The ratty locks almost seem like an apology for her delicate and classically beautiful features. The boy caressing the back of her neck is Hank. He flashes a high-wattage grin. His bare arms are covered in elaborately primitive designs, but these interlocking totems resemble magic marker scrawls more than actual tattoos. I try not to stare at the other boy whose disfigured profile seems to be the result of a terrible burn. Marcus has sparkling eyes that belie his taciturn expression. He slides over to make room for me in their booth. Lena takes out a wallet constructed of black duct tape and extracts a photograph that's been folded into 8 equal-sized squares. She arranges the image in front of me. "This is Kin," she explains. It's a grainy shot of a small rock club. There are low ceilings, black curtains tacked against the walls, a set of speakers dangling above the wooden stage. Several pasty guys play an assortment of drums, trumpets, dismantled synthesizers, and cable patches. But the focus is on the lead singer with his frizzy blonde locks and a red scarf wrapped around his squat neck. This has to be Kin Mersey. His mouth open wide, his teeth bared. He's captured mid-yawp. He coddles a battered acoustic guitar in the crook of his arms like a sleeping infant and appears utterly lost in the undertow of the song. "This is from his final show," Marcus says. "It's the last confirmed picture of him." "He quit in the middle of the tour," Hank adds. "He sold all his instruments on a street corner and vanished. Nobody has seen him in years." I examine the photo more closely. There's something unsettling about the way Kin seems so absorbed in the moment, his eyes white as boiled eggs, rolled back into their sockets. "Why'd he quit?" I ask. "Nobody knows," Lena says. She takes a long sip of tea and swallows hard. I notice the dusting of silver spray paint on her knuckles and the base of the cup. "I saw the graffiti," I say. "I wasn't sure what it meant." Lena flips over the photograph of Kin Mersey. On the backside, there's a smaller image of Kin, sitting on a stoop wearing a paper crown on his head. It's rakishly askew. He probably got it from a fast food restaurant, but it still manages to look defiantly regal. "The crown is a symbol," she explains. "It started as some inside joke, but the image struck." As she talks, her hand obsessively traces and retraces the image. "There are rumors Kin is hiding out in one of the nearby projects. We did the tags to get his attention, to coax him out into the open." She straightens the collar of her immaculately tattered raincoat. "That's also why I gave you the tape." "But why me?" I ask. "You're on the street," Lena says. "You know what's really happening." She sweeps aside her multicolored tresses so there's nothing obscuring her eyes. "You must have heard some stories about Kin. You have to know something." Her challenging and imploring look make this feel like a test. Though it's pretty obvious I don't know a thing, there still seems to be a correct response. I close my eyes and recall Kin's unearthly voice. "Maybe he hasn't quit," I say. "Maybe he's making music in secret. Maybe he's waiting for people to catch up to his new sounds. There's a stretch of silence where the only noises are the clank of utensils in the kitchen and the murmur of foreign dialects. Then Lena smiles. She says to her friends, "I told you he was all right." Lena pours some tea into a chipped china cup and hands it to me. It's a clear liquid that turns out to be pure grain alcohol. I cough after the first burning swallow. Marcus laughs and pats me on the back. "We love the tea here," he says. "It's their specialty. You'll get a taste for it pretty quick." Hank remains silent. He still seems to be evaluating me. His arms are crossed and his thumb circles one of the black totems on his bicep. His gaze remains trained on me. "Before we get all cozy," he says, "we need you to do something for us." Hank looks pointedly at Lena. She nods and fishes in the inner pocket of her overcoat. She places a runny can of silver spray paint on the table, then slides the cardboard stencil next to it. Lastly, she produces a cassette from her bag that looks strikingly similar to mine. She gives me a shrug that seems apologetic, almost. Hank says, "Paint some tags around the neighborhood to help us spread the word." He says, "Give the tape to someone who might have information about Kin and see what you can find out." He says, "Once you've done that, come find us."
Half past midnight, both headlights gone dead. Half past midnight, both headlights gone dead. But I'm driving.
This is Nathan D. Duvall, and you're listening to Rock Is Lit.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Welcome back to Rock Is Lit, Nathan.
Hey, it's great to be here. Congratulations on 50. It's very exciting.
And thank you, Cater, for being here as well.
Thank you, Christy. I'm excited.
So, Nathan, the situation this time is that there's a rock star in Jeff's novel Miracopora named Ken Mersey, and he disappeared after a performance. There are all these rumors and lore and myths surrounding what happened to him or what may have happened to him, but nobody's seen him for ages until some teenagers come across this bootleg cassette of what they think is his final show, and they start to search for him. In part one, Jeff mentioned that the rock star he used as sort of a model for this character was Jeff Mangum from Neutral Milk Hotel. Have y'all ever heard of him?
I know the band. He disappeared?
Apparently there's a period where he just sort of fell off the map, but didn't disappear as in never heard from again.
Gotcha.
So he was knocking off some other names of reclusive rock stars like Syd Barrett from Pink Floyd, Alex Chilton, a big star, Skip Spence from Moby Grape. Again, musicians who sort of went underground, but it's not like they were never heard from again. But that's exactly what I want to talk about with you guys. What are some instances where that actually has happened?
Nathan, the first person you mentioned when I asked you to come back on the podcast and told you what the topic was Richie Edwards from Manic Street Preachers. Now, I'd never heard of him before. Give us some background on Richie, then tell us about what happened to him.
Sure. It's kind of one of those instances where I think there was a culmination of things that were going on, and then the extra pressure of going to the United States to do a press junket for their album, Holy Bible, might have been something that kind of put him over the top. He was one of these characters that he wasn't, you know, an accomplished musician necessarily, but he had a great vision. He was a good designer, and he was a lyricist for the band. And he also suffered from mental health issues. He was a known cutter, and he spoke about it in interviews that he felt a certain command or control of his emotions when he cut. And yeah, he apparently wrote a kind of prophetic message to his sister and included a Sylvia Plath poem.
Tulips.
About tulips. Right. Yeah. And then he checked into a hotel, and then he disappeared. And his car was found not too far from a bridge, a location where people were known to, you know, to jump. And what was odd was a week after he disappeared, and it became a news item, a fan recognized him on the street and said they had a full-on conversation with him, but this fan didn't know that he was missing. I mean, eyewitness accounts are always challenging, but that did seem to be somewhat credible, that he may have been out for a week or two while he was missing, and then, you know, probably committed suicide. And it's frustrating because there's no closure for the family. And it does seem like a lot of the angles are pointing toward him doing himself harm, because there were just too many things kind of building up. And so, yeah, it most likely happened that way, that he just did himself in.
The family went ahead and declared him presumed dead in 2008, I think.
It took a long time. Yeah, like over 10 years. It's really frustrating.
So, Cater, didn't you come across some information that indicated that he had relatives who've done this sort of thing before?
Yes, I believe I read about him having an uncle that went off the grid for about 10 years and who kind of came back and decided to start teaching again, decided that that's what he wanted to do. And Richie always kind of looked up to him for that. He always talked about that and sort of respected his ambition to just go off and disappear.
How did his fans react when the news first broke that he was missing?
I think people took it pretty hard. And what's interesting, what I love about British bands, especially from that period, from like the late 80s into the late 90s, sometimes there was a character in the band. There's a guy named Bez who was in the Happy Mondays. And here in the United States, we might consider him a mascot because he provided percussion. But most importantly, Bez just danced. He danced like a lunatic on stage at the Happy Mondays. Every show never fails. And Bez partied harder than anybody. The legend is. And here we don't really understand it, but I think in the UK, they become a representation of the audience on the stage. And I think it was similar with Richie, because he was a roadie for the band. He just worshipped Manic Street Preachers. And then eventually his dedication to the band and his excellence as a writer helped him become the main lyricist and singer and sort of front person for the band for that period of time, for whatever that was, 4 or 5 years. And I think that's why fans and people in the UK really take it hard, because if Bez were to, I think Bez is still alive and is considered like the soul of the Happy Mondays along with Sean Ryder. And I think that it was similar for Richie, that he kind of lived out a dream that a lot of people, like Christy, you like imagine like suddenly you became the guitar tech for Jimmy Page. I mean,
oh my God.
it's the same idea. Like, where that doesn't happen in American bands in general. Like, you don't, like Kurt Cobain was a huge Mudhoney fan, and he teched for them for a while, or carried, was running around the band with them. And not just Mudhoney, the Melvins.
Yeah.
The Melvins. And I think he worked more with that for them. And Buzz was like, you just got to start your own band. And it's similar, where I think a lot of people really identified with Richie And they took it pretty hard because he was the representation of the audience on stage in the band. And to have him kind of implode like that was just gut-wrenching.
It is interesting that when he disappeared, he was 27. So one way or another, he has joined that club.
Mm-hmm.
Boo. And that's that. Yeah.
Sorry.
And coincidentally, I think he disappeared around the same time that Kurt Cobain committed suicide. And
okay,
they were kind of linked in a sort of representation, like the poet for pains, sort of. And just like having young people empathize with what they were saying in their lyrics.
I'm just going to throw this out here. This is the second time Nathan and Cater and I have tried to do this interview. The recording of the first interview magically disappeared, as in just never seen or heard from again, while we're doing a conversation about musicians who have disappeared. So I don't know if Richie's got something to do with this or this next person we're getting ready to talk about, but I find that very interesting. But in the first conversation, I found out that, Cater, you are a fan of Connie Converse.
That's right.
And she was a 50s and 60s singer-songwriter. I'll let you give more information about her in a second. But she disappeared in 74. Give me a little background on her.
Yeah, so Connie Converse is sort of almost a Van Gogh type figure where didn't get a lot of attention in her own time, but went on to inspire just countless artists and songwriters. She came up in New York City in the 50s, just playing for friends and in various cafes and establishments. And she was just a really, really gifted in terms of melody and structuring songs and poetic lyricism. She was just a really gifted folk singer that was probably about 10 years ahead of her time in terms of the folk explosion in New York City with the likes of
right,
Dylan and Joan Baez. But people nowadays like Angel Olsen, who lives in Nashville, and Adrian Linker, Big Thief, cite her as one of their biggest influences. But probably the most famous thing about her is her disappearance, which happened in 74. After years of trying to sell her music, she moved to Ann Arbor, became a writer and an editor. And about after 10 years of doing that, her life just wasn't going well. She didn't feel accomplished and she fell into a deep depression, drank and smoked heavily. Her friends and family tried to help her with her mood by traveling and trying to be of support. But she had kind of reached a point where she decided that she wanted to head out and make a new life. And she said that she was going to go make a new life in New York City and return to the place where she was performing a lot. But in 1974, she wrote a bunch of handwritten letters to her friends and family. You can read a lot of those online if you're interested in reading those. She's a very poetic writer, even in letters. And she was never heard from again. She took off in her Volkswagen Bug, which we talked about as sort of the calling card of the disappeared musician, is that you got to disappear in a Volkswagen.
Yep.
Just leave all your stuff.
Yep.
And she was never heard from again. And it sort of became this big mystery that people talk about. There was a big New York Times article about it, I think, last year. And yeah, I've been a fan of her for a while. Me and my girlfriend listen to her a lot. You know, I'm a big folk fan and big Bob Dylan fan. And they sort of had this connection. There's actually a lot of people in the article talking about how she's a much better version of all these folk artists that came after her.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I think her stuff has aged really well. There's a compilation of all of her songs on Spotify or any streaming that you should check out if you're interested in that.
So she recorded a bunch of stuff, but she never did get a record deal.
No, I think they're all pretty much live recordings or some from her friends. You can hear chatter from her friends around.
Oh, okay. Nathan, had you ever heard of her?
No, the name sounds familiar. You know, that's one area, folk music in general, that I'm not as well versed. I have a few favorites. Like, I grew up as a Leonard Cohen kid, but I never, you know, I never went really deep into it. But no, anyway, I don't know them. And I love that idea that she has these kind of live recordings. I love that, Cater, where where you can hear people in the background. It makes it seem like you're there, or you're kind of listening in on something you should. And there's nothing prefabricated about it. Like when you go into a studio and it's just pure. I think that's really cool.
Yeah, Jeff said something in part one about some artists just losing their sense of destiny and just deciding to disappear in one form or another. And it kind of sounds like she's a prime candidate for that theory. Her career was not working out. She wasn't having any success. And, you know, maybe she just decided, we don't know. We really don't know if she killed herself or if she just moved away and started over. But in any event, she'd be almost 100 years old right now. She was born in 1924. So it's highly unlikely that she's still alive. So I guess we'll never know.
No. It's always a tragedy when someone is ahead of their time and they can't be appreciated for that because, you know, by definition, don't fit in that time period.
How sad, how lovely, how short.
So you mentioned VWs. We're going to talk about another person who disappeared in a VW, Jim Sullivan. I first heard about him a few months ago, and I don't remember how or where, but I just remember being struck by his story. And he was this psychedelic folk singer-songwriter, and he was in LA trying to make a go of it. And he actually did make a couple of albums. The first one was called UFO, and it came out in 1969. And he was a big extraterrestrial person. He would go out to the desert sometimes and try to encounter UFOs. And his wife was a believer as well. But he was hanging out in Hollywood with people like Dennis Hopper. He had an uncredited appearance in Easy Rider. But like with Connie, he just couldn't make that leap to stardom. It just wasn't working out. So what do you guys know about Jim Sullivan?
I read something where he had a great A&R rep, I think. I think the recording budget was ridiculous. Man, I don't know. It's such an interesting strategy when someone is new, especially then, like back like early 70s, late 60s, you really didn't need to spend that much money. And you had time to build an artist, like over four albums, maybe something like that. Going into the 80s and 90s, a little different. But when you spend that kind of money, there's so much pressure. You lose a lot of the magic that's in the demo. That's very common where a band will have something amazing. There's just something intangible aspect about the recording on this demo. And then you go in and you record and you bring in all the heavy hitters and it just doesn't happen. It's very common. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the argument with Sullivan, that there was something that got muddied when they went big and, you know, just brought in everything they possibly could to make this a big hit, and it didn't happen. And that's got to be so frustrating for an artist when you're like, well, what, you know, we tried everything, you know, we brought in it all, yeah. And it just didn't happen. I listened to UFO again, and it's so weird. I mean, I can totally understand why it didn't go over, because it is completely unique. It doesn't sound like anything.
I really like it, though. I like that album.
Exactly. I'm not putting it down, but like, it, if you were the radio sales guys, that like Charlie Minor, I don't know if he was there in the early 70s, but it would have been hard for someone like him to try and sell that. I mean, when you listen to it, where do you, you know, it would probably be big on like public radio. Like that would be a place where I would go with that album, because I just don't hear it among, you know, Bread or whatever, like, you know, like whatever the, you know,
baby,
the song,
won't you know, you?
Yeah, I just, you know, I can't live, or, you know, whatever the song might be. Like,
right.
It doesn't fit any of the formats. So I see why it tanked. You're just like, what do you do with it? It's so weird.
I think with Jim Sullivan, especially, he was sort of like the all-American like winner growing up. He was like the high school football captain who ended up marrying like the prom queen. he was very used to success and accolades, I guess you could say.
Instant success, right.
But was also very committed to music and really wanted to make it, and still did, up to his disappearance, it seems.
Yeah, because he was headed for Nashville. Well, back up a little bit. He and his wife started having trouble because he was hitting the bottle pretty hard. When things didn't go well with the career, he turns to alcohol, and there's some friction in the marriage, and he decides that he's going to go to Nashville, make a new start. But he didn't intend to break up the family. He just wanted to go, see what he could do, and bring the family out. So it doesn't make sense to me that he would set all that up and then go kill himself. But we don't know what happened to him. He was in the New Mexico desert, and his car was found with his guitar in it. And that was a tip off to close friends who said, oh, no, he would never leave his guitar.
Right.
But his body was never found. We don't know what happened to him either.
Skinwalkers.
Oh. Yep. Yep. I found it interesting last time we talked. I think you brought up the Manson connection, Nathan.
Just that, yeah, if he was around those guys in the 68, 69, he probably bumped into that crew. Not that, like you were pointing out, that there weren't that many people left on the ranch. Most were in jail by that time.
Yeah, the ranch actually burned down in 70, 71. So they dispersed, but that's interesting. Maybe he did associate with some of those folks before they were arrested.
The mob is listed as a possible reason. Did we ever figure out why, did he owe money or something? Was he a gambler, or was the album funded by the mob or something? That's common, but I don't know. I think we said before, the mob wouldn't kill you in general for that. They want their money back, and it would make sense to keep him alive a little longer to try and get their money back through a new album or something, unless he did something else that had nothing to do with lending money, which is possible. But I just found that odd that was listed part of the wiki, Goopy the Mob.
Tater, tell us about the phone call that he made. Wasn't it to his wife when he got to New Mexico?
That's right. I think a big reason people believe that there's some sort of connection with mob or aliens or something like that interfering.
Mob aliens.
Yeah, the mob or aliens. Is the phone call that he had with his wife. It was about a day after he left for Nashville. He has these plans. He wants to make money selling songs and bring his family down. But a day out, he calls his wife very cryptically and says, hey, everything is fine. And his wife's confused because why would there be anything wrong?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't he be fine? And she asks him what's wrong. And he says, you wouldn't believe if I told you.
Ooh.
Which is a very just open-ended, cryptic thing to say.
Yeah, pretty ominous.
Yeah, it's almost like he knew he was either in danger or he was going through something very strange. We don't know. But after that, he got pulled over on suspicion of intoxicated driving by a police officer, but he passed that sobriety test, so we don't know the situation there either.
Mm-hmm.
He checked into a hotel. Apparently, he didn't even use the beds. All the sheets were still tucked in. And then they found that Volkswagen with also symbolically, as well as his guitar, two of his records, the two records he produced and made.
Oh, wow.
It's almost like he was leaving all that behind, and the pressures of those two records, along with his guitar and papers and money and clothes.
Well, something else that I think is interesting, some of the lyrics in that album, UFO, not only do they reference UFOs, but they reference just disappearing. So I don't know. I mean, it seems strange to me that he would kill himself. So I think he either died in the desert and the animals got him, or somebody killed him and buried him. I think that makes more sense to me than suicide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. Maybe I don't know if he was into psychedelics, but he could have just kind of gotten lost out there after a bad trip.
Hey, have you seen the cover of UFO? He was into psychedelics.
Right, he did make some pretty psychedelic music.
Hells yeah.
Just shaking like a leaf on the desert heat. His daddy's got a bang that's so hard to beat. I bought me a ticket, got a front row seat. I'm checking out the show with a glassy eye, looking at the sun dancing through the sky. Did he come by UFO?
Okay, I'm going to mispronounce this next person's name, and she is yet another one that I had never heard of. Christina Licorice McKechnie or McKechnie. Is she Scottish? Is she Scottish?
She is from Edinburgh.
Okay.
Yes.
So she played with the Incredible String Band, and they were at Woodstock in 69. But she's another one who is thought to have disappeared in the desert. 1990, but in the desert, I don't think she had a VW. I think she was hitchhiking or something.
That's right.
Did we ever find out why they called her Licorice?
You know, I didn't really look into that. I guess maybe she was very sweet. So Incredible String Band were sort of a hippie collective of musicians that, if you listen to them, it's very stuck in that era of Flower Children, the 60s movement, and the Woodstock era, obviously. So she was part of that movement. She was from Edinburgh. She was an adventurous spirit, and she kind of ran away from home like a lot of girls in the 60s did to go marry a musician. And then she left that musician for another musician, and this musician, Robin Williamson, started the Incredible String Band and said, hey, I'm going to bring you into this. And she became an important member of that band. She was the percussionist and the background singer. And she was on that stage at Woodstock. She actually disappeared a while after the band sort of fell apart. They fell apart in 1974. She left the band 2 years earlier and sort of became a wanderer after that point. Was known for hitchhiking across the Arizona desert. Her family heard from her occasionally. The last time she was heard from was from her sister. She was apparently recovering from a surgery, and she was communicated with her sister.
Do you know what year that was?
I believe it was 1990, the same year she disappeared.
Okay.
And yeah, she disappeared in 1990, somewhere in the Arizona desert. A lot of people think she just wandered out. A lot of people think that there's a lot of dangers associated with hitchhiking.
I can't believe she's still hitchhiking in 1990.
Right.
Definitely heightened danger if she's doing that.
Yeah. A member of her band said there's a possibility she may be dead. Just might have been a tragic disappearance. But some people theorize that the Incredible String Band's connection with Scientology had something to do with it. That's sort of like the mob or aliens or Manson family connection that we kind of have to force on it. Because some of the band did dabble in Scientology, apparently before it had its reputation that it did now, and had its reputation for making people disappear. So it is a mysterious case just because she's not very documented in terms of what she was doing during that time.
Well, I guess she'll stay a mystery too. This next person is the most bizarre thing that you came up with. Cater did a lot of research on this, and this is about Jim Morrison. Okay, now we all know he supposedly died in a bathtub in Paris in 1971. And there's a lot of different thoughts out there about how he died, whether it was a heart attack or drugs or murder even. Well, Cater, you came up with some information that said Jim Morrison actually is still alive and possibly living in Oregon. Please tell me about that.
I was having trouble finding stuff on this, but eventually I stumbled on a great conspiracy theory website that had just all this information and great pictures of Bill Boyer, who is apparently Jim Morrison now and Jim Morrison's face and them transitioning into each other. It's a great layout, a lot of discussion in the forum. And so the theory is he faked his death and he moved to an isolated ranch in the Oregon desert under the name Bill Boyer. And if you look up the name Bill Boyer, you can look at this sort of old guy in a cowboy hat. In this picture I'm looking at, he's holding a shotgun and a pistol. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he looks like a guy from a ranch in Oregon, but he's got sort of this face that people think looks a lot like an aged Jim Morrison, with the kind of strong nose and the chin. And a lot of people have thought that it's him. I think the death of Jim Morrison has a lot of questions surrounding it. There's a lot of theories about, a lot of hearsay about where he actually died. Like, was it, did they bring him into the bathroom after he died in a club? A lot of people say that. And there was no autopsy performed on Jim Morrison. So his official cause of death was heart attack, but he was on drugs at the time. And a lot of people reasonably say it's an overdose, but we can't be sure. There's a lot of conspiracy theories surrounding Jim Morrison, also because of his father, who was a very powerful person in the Navy.
Yeah, he was a rear admiral.
He was at the Bill Tonkin.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, Nathan, tell me a little bit more about, I think you said the last time we talked, you had seen a documentary about the last days of Jim Morrison.
I've seen a ton of stuff. Kate, I'm looking at this right now. The bigfooty.com is awesome. I love a good conspiracy theory about this. What's funny is that he looks more like Bill Graham than he does Jim Morrison, I think. Kind of funny. When you see Jim's face, especially in 1971, it became more puffy.
Yeah.
Like he lost the deep cheekbones and the cheeks, the way the cheeks kind of pock in. Like, it's interesting, the guy they chose as Bill Boyer character. It's awesome.
Yeah.
There's a lot of information now about the last 2 days of his life. And it's just really sad. I mean, it sounds like that he most likely had emphysema, and he was showing a lot of signs of someone with early emphysema. And probably the worst thing for him was Pamela, his common-law wife, was addicted to heroin, and she was a mess. And I'm not blaming it on her at all, just that they were together, those two, they were a toxic couple, and they didn't bring out the best in each other. And where she did kind of get him away from the classic drinking buddies that he had down there on Santa Monica Boulevard, the problem was is that he still partied just as hard with her and then was getting into heroin. And he wouldn't shoot it, but he would sniff it from time to time. And the owner of the Rock and Roll Circus, which was the club that he was frequenting to get her heroin, admitted near his death that he OD'd in the bathroom. He was close to death or near dead or dead. I don't think they knew, but he OD'd in the bathroom, and the two dealers that sold him the heroin took him outside, and then I think they got him to their flat. That's what's murky. We don't know if that he was alive or dead when he most likely got to that flat. The club owner said that he was dead in his opinion, but you never really know in those cases. He might have been clinging to life, but it is pretty well known that she rushed a big payment to Père Lachaise and got him buried among all these poets and Edith Piaf and these great performers. Chopin is there.
Oscar Wilde.
Yeah, it's a perfect place for him. And they rushed it in. And the problem was, like you're saying, Cater, is that Bill Siddons, their manager, was very young. He was in his early 20s. He was their road manager and then became their manager. And he was so freaked out when he arrived because Pamela was crying and just in hysterics that he never opened the casket. He never saw Jim. Which leads to this whole, these awesome, ideas that he went to Africa or that he's Bill Boyer or whoever it might be. Again, like kind of like Richie, there's all these signs that point to this because there was a notorious, incredibly pure, bad batch of heroin that went around in northern France that killed all these people. And that was part of the batch that killed both Pamela's lover, the guy that got him the heroin. I'm forgetting his name. He was royalty in some distant way. And he knew these dealers, and he was most likely behind the heroin that killed him, and it ended up killing him also.
Mm.
And what's interesting is that Keith Richards was quoted as saying, "I feel so lucky that we were in the south of France and that we had a different connection. We were going through these Corsican guys, and his Corsican connection kept them with pretty solid heroin, and they never had a problem, while all these people in northern France died. And that's still, again, like all these different arrows are pointing to that fact that he probably snorted it up. He had emphysema. He was in a really bad state. It was already incredibly pure heroin, and he just died. And it just, it's such a, like a cliche and frustrating way. And I'm so happy, like as a fan, that they created this whole, you know, aura and allure of mystery around the death, because it made it a lot more interesting than just another guy ODing on drugs, which sucks. I don't know. It just adds to the mystery and to the whole interesting aspect about the band. And again, like he was obsessed with sex and death, and it's fun as a fan, because around LA, there's all these great sights that you can experience, whether it's down in Venice or it's in West Hollywood, the various places he lived there with Pamela, or the Alta Cienega Hotel, where you can rent a really cheesy motel room that's covered in graffiti and have fun with your partner or whatever. There's a lot of fun things you can do because of this fact that they solidified a mystery, and then they buried him in this absolutely perfect place in Père Lachaise.
Anybody listening, if you ever get a chance to go to that cemetery in Paris, definitely do it. I mean, it's a beautiful cemetery anyway, but you've got to go see his grave. There's always a lot of really interesting characters hanging around. It's a fun place to visit.
And it's got those classic concert gates.
Yep.
The barriers they put up at festival concerts or anywhere there's, you know, a serious event going on, like for crowd control. It's so awesome. The guy's dead and they still have crowd control at his grave. I love that. I think it's so funny. I mean, no one is that hardcore. No one rocks that hard that they have to like maintain peace at his grave. You're like, right on. It's awesome.
So apparently, Jeff Jackson told me in part one, Jim Morrison, and we're reading about some of the conspiracy theories about him, was another source of inspiration for his Ken Mersey character. But right before we jumped on the Zoom call, I came across this article from 2016. I can't remember where it's from, but it was claiming that Jim is alive and living as a homeless hippie in New York. And his name is Richard. So, you know, next time you go to New York, be on the lookout for
Richard.
Right.
When the music's over, when the music's over here, when the music's over, turn up the lights, turn up the lights, turn up the lights.
Okay, well, these are fascinating stories. And Cater, I think you had a more general question that you wanted to ask before we wrap this up. Do you want to jump on that?
Well, I've noticed a common thing among a lot of these disappearances either have to do with fatigue from the music industry or the inability to make it in the music industry. And since you're someone in the music industry who's had some success, I'm wondering if that journey to trying to be successful with art and music kind of produces a lot of those sort of breakdowns and just kind of the sort of what you were talking about, Christy, of destiny fatigue or giving up on the destiny. Does that happen a lot? And what's your experience with that?
I think it makes sense that people leave their hometown or their grounding sense of person to go create a new character or a new individual or another part of themselves. And a lot of times, especially if you come to a big city like New York or Los Angeles and Miami, you go to reinvent yourself and you get kind of lost. And it's for all spectrum of success or non-success or whatever you term as success, it's a lot healthier now. And especially here in Asheville, people take success differently. They're much happier. As long as you can survive and you know you have health insurance and if you have a family, whatever you're doing that makes you happy, people seem a lot more comfortable with what others might consider moderate local success because you can have a happier life. Where those who go to a big city get kind of lost in the trappings of whatever they believe success is and whether they attain it or they don't attain it, it always comes back to that problem of not having a grounding sense of self, and probably more importantly, of giving to others, of finding a way to volunteer and make yourself valuable and pass on your knowledge or whatever your special gift is to other people. That gets lost for sure in a city like Los Angeles, because you're just in an absolute all-out war to become successful or reach the right amount of people you think that are going to help catapult you to whatever level you think you need. And most times you get there and you find you're unhappy because you weren't happy to begin with. I think it's similar for a lot of the people we were talking about, where they weren't necessarily grounded and they just lost their way, you know, as a metaphor, and then, you know, probably lost their lives, whether it was drugs and alcohol, misadventure, whatever it might be. It's in especially that age range we're talking about, where it's your 20s, it's so easy to just go over the edge and not make it. And it's even more sad when it's someone like Licorice, where she's much older and she should have been able to hopefully find some kind of peace at that age, but didn't. It's so difficult because I'm, as someone who's in middle age now, a lot of my friends are struggling. Yeah. I'm struggling. It is a weird time. And I think it's tough where society tells you, hey, you know, you should be happy at this age, or you should be settled at this age. And then when things are not working out, where the picture book example that was given to you is not happening that way, it makes it even more frustrating. So I can see where at all different points in your life, you can hit these walls. And I just feel for these folks that, yeah, especially where they go missing and their loved ones or fans are unable to like kind of close that chapter. And maybe in the case of Jim, it was more fun maybe to leave it open. And we created this hilarious mystique that, you know, young kids can kind of groove on. It seemed to happen, you know, every generation.
The whole myth of the reclusive rock star or the rock star that disappears, all of the lore is fascinating to me. So I'm really glad that we could have a chance to talk about this again. And hopefully the ghosts of these people, if they are in fact dead, will not again keep the recording from actually being produced. So we'll see. We'll see what happens to this one.
Second time's a charm.
Yeah. Thanks so much for being a part of the first and the 50th episode of Rock is Lit, Nathan. It was wonderful having both you and Jeff back on. It was just a real treat for me. So thank you so much for doing that.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be a guest, and I'm really happy for you, and congratulations on 50. That was awesome.
Thank you so much. And thank you, Cater Jones, for joining Nathan and me for this convo and for all you do for Rock is Lit.
Thank you, Chrissy. Love talking with you guys. We should do this every week.
It was fun. Well, if the ghosts of these musicians take this recording, we'll be doing it again tomorrow.
That's right.
Thanks again, guys.
Awesome. Where is there I want to go? Where it's at to roam? Is it a place out there? Just a town down there? If you're driving slow, where it's at, Jerome?
If you missed part one of episode 50 featuring my interview with Jeff Jackson about his novel Mira Kapora, make sure you check it out. Catch Nathan D. Duval's Lucid Show Mondays from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on 103.3 Asheville FM, or check it out on Spotify as Lucid Pilot. And pick up a copy of Jeff Jackson's fabulous novel, Mira Kapora, as well as his other novels, including Destroy All Monsters, at your local indie bookstore or wherever you buy books. And finally, Wyatt, the Rockiest Lit mascot, and I would like to thank all the Lit listeners out there who've supported the podcast for the first 50 episodes. Until next time, keep rocking and reading and getting lit.
Rock is lit. It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.